This is a petition for further review, so Ms. Duffy, you may proceed. Mr. Chapin and Ms. Duffy, does anybody have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
No.
I'd like to.
You may proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska, who petitioned this court for further review of the Nebraska Court of Appeals opinion, which reversed the district court's order dismissing Brown's motion to vacate or reconsider as untimely. Pending specific direction from this court, I intend to just give a brief overview of the procedural history of the case and then move into a discussion of why the state petitioned for further review. Very briefly, Brown filed a motion for post-conviction relief. The district court denied it without an evidentiary hearing in September 2020, and no appeal was filed. In January 2021, Brown filed a motion asking the district court to do one of two things. First, either vacate and reissue its order denying post-conviction relief to allow him to appeal because he alleged that post-conviction counsel had failed to timely inform him of the denial of his motion for post-conviction relief, or in the alternate, to reconsider its previous order which denied him an evidentiary hearing. The district court stated the motion was untimely and dismissed it, and Brown appealed. The Court of Appeals, relying on this court's opinions in State v. Jones and State v. Parnell, held that Brown's motion to vacate or reconsider was not untimely in light of those opinions, and it reversed the matter to the district court for reconsideration on the merits. The state asked this court for further review because we believe that the Court of Appeals incorrectly relied on Jones and Parnell in finding the motion was not untimely and in remanding the case for reconsideration. Both Jones and Parnell dealt with claims of that an appeal had been lost due to official negligence. And here the allegation is that an appeal was lost due to actions of post-conviction counsel. And so the state believes that Jones and Parnell are inapplicable to this instance and that the Court of Appeals' reliance on those cases was an error.
Was the motion for reconsideration untimely in the sense that it was outside of the term or the statutory extension of term of the original denial of the post-conviction order?
It was outside the term, but not outside that statutory 6 month extension provided by 25-2001, Your Honor.
So you would agree, I take it, that the district court had the authority to entertain the motion for reconsideration?
Yes, Your Honor.
And thus the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction to review the district court's denial of the motion for reconsideration.
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting you bring up jurisdiction. I see today has been jurisdiction day. late yesterday afternoon while preparing for this oral argument, I did see an issue that I think that I was incorrect on when I argued to the Court of Appeals and to this court in the petition for further review that there is jurisdiction over the portion of Brown's motion that requests reconsideration of the denial of post-conviction relief. So to kind of split it up, as I mentioned, there were two asks. There was one, vacate and reissue your order so that I can appeal. And the second ask was, rethink your decision. I think it was wrong. And based on this court's opinions, Capital Construction, McEwen, and recently Green v. Seifert, which is 304-NEB-212-2019, that case stated that while an order denying a motion to vacate or modify is appealable, if it is based on grounds that make it independently final and appealable. In the Green case, this court stated that the appellant's motion to vacate in that case merely contended the order she sought to vacate was erroneous, and this court found it did not have jurisdiction to review denial of that motion. So I believe that that analysis applies to the portion of Brown's order, Brown's motion that requested the district court reconsider its denial of an evidentiary hearing. And so I don't believe the court has jurisdiction over that portion, and so it would not need to affirm on the alternate ground that the denial, while correct, not for the reason that it was untimely, but for the reason that its original order was correct. So as to that portion, I now question whether there is jurisdiction on that issue. I'm happy to keep discussing that one. I know jurisdiction is really fun today, but the state does believe that there is jurisdiction over the portion of the motion that requested the court vacate and reissue its order denying post-conviction relief in order to allow time to appeal. This court has noted that while a district court does have inherent power to modify its orders, it cannot do so in order to evade the legislatively created appellate deadlines.
And let's back up for just a second. Suppose the district court had not done what it did, but said, okay, you filed this motion for reconsideration. I've looked again at the post-conviction motion, and I think there's something that requires an evidentiary hearing. I'm going to reverse my previous order and order an evidentiary hearing. Are you asserting that the district court would not have had jurisdiction to do that?
No, I apologize. The district court could have. I meant the Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction over the appeal from, since the district court did not reconsider its order. It just, everything's okay. You know, here it didn't give that as a reason, but it dismissed it, which essentially says, I'm not changing my mind. There would not be appellate jurisdiction of that issue. So that is a contention. The district court could have, because it was within the 6 month, I guess, kind of look back period, I call it, would have been able, if it had seen an error, to say, yes, you're right. And then that would have kind of, it wouldn't have been, you know, an order nunc-pro-tunc or just a reiterate my same order. It would have been a whole new order because it would have changed the rulings.
So now you want to fast forward to Parnell and...
You know, I'm happy to talk about whatever this court would like to discuss, but I think the state's main contention, setting aside the jurisdictional issue on that part, is that Parnell and Jones are applicable to actions of official negligence. And here we do not have an allegation of official negligence. And so the district court could not grant the relief that Brown sought. We believe Parnell and Jones are inapplicable to a situation such as this. And so we would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and to instead affirm the judgment of the district court, albeit on different grounds than the timeliness issue.
What are Parnell and Jones based upon?
I apologize. I'm going to get to the case just so I don't incorrectly. I mean,
is it statutory?
Well, I think Parnell cited to State v. Smith, which I have not looked at, but it to some, the case in Parnell, the allegation was that the clerk court had not mailed the notice to Parnell, and this court noted that, there's absent evidence to the contrary, there is a presumption that officers have performed their duties, but that Parnell should be given the opportunity to show to the contrary. And you know, I think both Parnell and Jones dealt with cases of a state action. So the state doing something, a state actor that prevented an appeal. And so I think that is why, or I suppose I'm trying to read the mind of this court, and that's maybe not the wisest thing to do. But both of those cases found that in those situations, an appellant is entitled to a hearing to attempt to prove up that some official negligence occurred that prevented a timely appeal.
If post-conviction counsel, as alleged here, doesn't alert the defendant to the motion being denied, and the time runs, and Jones and Parnell aren't available, is there just no remedy?
I think that is the case, Your Honor. I do note here that the allegation was that post-conviction counsel did notify appellant, but not in only a day or two before the appellate clock run. But yes, I do believe that.
You mean no remedy under the Post-Conviction Act?
Correct, Your Honor. I apologize. Yes, there's no remedy under the Post-Conviction Act, and Jones and Parnell would not serve under the state's view to allow for the appeal to sort of be revived.
To the extent Jones and Parnell may have been, I want to say, constitutional in nature in terms of a broad, dare I say, substantive due process, or perhaps only a procedural due process, is it your position they cannot be imported from official negligence into attorney negligence and serve as a constitutional basis in post-conviction?
Well, the state notes that post-conviction relief is a statutory right, and that
for a constitutional violation.
I suppose, but the remedies available and the rules governing it are set by the legislature. And so if the legislature wishes to change, for example, ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel as a claim, it is free to do so. But because, you know, in direct appeal, there's a constitutional right, and post-conviction relief is statutory, and not everyone gets it. There are rules in place, and if an appellant misses a deadline on that 1 year, they do not receive review. And so the state believes in this case, unless there are additional questions, we'd request you reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and affirm the judgment of the district court on alternate grounds. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chapin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. My name is Bill Chapin. I represent David Brown in this matter. And first of all, I'd like to point out that this case does not involve the definition of siblings, so that we can clear that up.
And we don't need a diagram.
Well, I have a diagram, because I was taking notes. But I think that where the state's position in this case misses the point of Parnell and Jones is that the individual in this case who didn't give notice was an attorney, a private attorney that was appointed by the court. I think what the point I'm getting to is that attorneys, whether we like it or not, are considered officers of the court. And as officers of the court, we have certain duties, and one of those are to notify people what's going on. Just like the clerks have a duty to notify people what's going on, and just like in the case of Jones, the caseworker has a duty to make sure the mail goes out in a timely manner, I can't imagine that an attorney, well, I can, but I mean, I can't imagine that an attorney says, well, I don't have to give my client notice that they got an unfavorable decision that's going to prevent them from appealing their post-conviction. And where this plays an extremely important part for a prisoner is jumping ahead to Rose v. Lundy. You know, if you don't exhaust your state remedies, you're not allowed to do a habeas in federal court. You're suddenly barred from raising issues that could theoretically show that there was an error in the trial court that means that you should not be incarcerated or, in fact, should not be incarcerated for the amount of time that you were incarcerated or sentenced to. So I think on that nature, this is has a more serious ramification than just missing the deadline. And I think in terms of what Mr. Brown did is, and this is where the facts are real interesting. The decision was issued in September 17th. Mr. Brown was notified on October 16th by a telephone call. He wasn't given the opinion. He was just notified, oh, by the way, 29 days ago, the court ruled against you. Yeah. You have 1 day, you have 24 hours to figure out what you're going to do. Also, you have 24 hours to, you know, if you're going to appeal it, you have to have 24 hours to get your affidavit on file, 24 hours to do X, Y, and Z for inform of paupers, 24 hours to get everything to the court.
Don't we have case law that characterizes the relationship between attorney and client as one of agency, the client being the principal and the lawyer being the agent?
Yes, we do.
And isn't notice to the agent notice to the principal? So when the court notified the lawyer, isn't that the end of the question of official negligence?
No, because I think that official negligence extends to notifying the principal.
Do you have any authority for that proposition?
I don't, but I think that from logic it would appear.
So even though our rules say the clerk, and the statute for years has said the clerk notifies counsel of record, you're saying in every instance there's a duty on the court clerk to notify not just the lawyer, but the party whom the lawyer represents.
Well, what I'm saying is that I think that the lawyer, who's an officer of the court, has a duty both to the court, and the duty that the officer of the court owes to the court is to make sure that the client is timely notified. Just like the clerk has to notify the agent needs to notify the principal. And so that's what I'm saying is the logical conclusion of being an officer.
Have we ever suggested that the official negligence requirement, which I agree derives from the constitutional requirement of effective counsel on direct appeal, applies to post-conviction counsel?
I'm not sure that I'm not aware of a case that standard specifically applies to post-conviction counsel, but the problem is that as an agent of the principal, if the principal wants to appeal, the agent needs to notify the principal in a timely manner.
So, as I understand your argument based on the truism, I suppose, that an attorney is an officer of the court in the sense that only persons who are admitted to practice may serve as attorneys at law. All of the attorneys at law are now, would under your theory or your proposed precedent in this case, be deemed officials of the government?
I don't think they become officials of the government. I think they do become, I think there is a standard and duty that they owe to the court that requires that they notify people in a timely manner so that people can perfect their appeals and their other proceedings.
Don't we have rules of discipline that apply to lawyers and failure to perform their responsibilities to clients?
Yes, we do.
So isn't that the remedy, and perhaps malpractice, or there may be other remedies, but I'm having great difficulty seeing any remedy under the Post-Conviction Act.
Well, I think the remedy is under Parnell versus Jones and the giving the proper notice, and when there isn't a proper notice, then the individual is entitled to at least a hearing on their motion.
If we disagree with you on that argument, mm-hmm. does that mean that we should do what the state requests, that we should reverse the Court of Appeals with direction to affirm the district court?
Well, I would not.
I know you don't want that result, but assuming that we disagree on the applicability of Parnell and Jones, doesn't that result then follow?
I suppose it would. I mean, if you say that that Jones and Parnell don't apply because this is a private attorney versus an official, state official, that would be the logical conclusion. But I think the problem becomes is that the remedy that then is available to Mr. Brown is obviously some sort of malpractice or some sort of disciplinary action. But that's not the remedy that gets him further review of his particular case. You know, the damages that he may or may not receive doesn't get him out of jail if there was an error at the trial court. Doesn't get him out of jail if he can't bring a post-conviction action and point out new evidence that wasn't available at the time. And it sure doesn't get him into federal court on a habeas because he can't exhaust his state remedies. So he doesn't get, it's sort of like, well, you know, you're losing $1 million, but we'll give you $5, call it even. It's not the same. It's clearly a violation. And I think the problem is that's why, as an officer of the court, which is spelled out in numerous cases, you know, State versus State Bar Association and Tesser, which is 183, points out the duties and officers of the court. But I think that's why I think the Court of Appeals was correct in applying Parnell and Jones to this kind of procedure.
Can you foresee any sort of difficulty were we to extend Parnell and Jones to the situation of a private counsel? What would happen in our trial courts?
Well, I can see a huge number of nightmares.
Yeah.
And the biggest.
How would you propose to manage those? Is there a way to put a collar on it, or limit it somehow? Do you see any way to limit it?
Well, I think there's...
Maybe I'm not imaginative enough.
Oh, well, let's assume for the sake of argument that someone who's incarcerated in jail may not be the most honest and trustworthy individual, and so that every time they miss a deadline, they blame their attorney.
And demand a hearing.
And demand that they have this and they have that right and they have this right and that right, etc. That creates a huge nightmare for the court and a burden for the court. However, if the attorney can show, hey, this is the mail, this is when they received it, this is when I went out and talked to them, and has it documented that they clearly notified the person in a timely manner, or they have an email that shows, here, I sent you a copy of the order. I sent it to you on the day we got it. You had 30 days to contact me. I put in the note, contact me, give me a call if you want to appeal. It seems that that shuts it down, you know.
Shuts it down after the hearing.
Well, shuts it down after the hearing, I suppose,
so,
yes.
The nightmare of hearings, as you
that,
characterize it,
that's, well, that
would be there.
That's yes, but that's only if the inmates would hear this argument and feel like they may have a shot. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No.
There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments in State versus Brown, and also concludes arguments for the day. So the court is adjourned. You are excused.